There is a monk of the Ramakrishna order, which was started by Vivekananda about 100 years ago, and at the monastery just across the river near Fenway Park. The center has been there since 1909, so we have been around for quite some time. I'm also a chaplain at Harvard. Okay, that, I think that's enough of an introduction. I would hazard the guess that love is probably one thing that's finds a mention or reference in some way in every religion. But the way that way the love is articulated and understood and theologically placed might be different. And in the Hindu tradition, love is the most Hindu texts see love as a power which leads to unity, which leads to bringing people and things together. And love expressed at the physical level or even at the mental level is really what sex is, according to this formulation. So I think before I make any further comments, I will just briefly mention the Hindu view of the human personality, because a lot of these terms, whether love, sex, and God, these are terms commonly used in different religions, but the way these terms are understood will differ according to the worldviews of those specific traditions. So as far as the human personality is concerned, the Hindu tradition sees the human personality as primarily trichotomous, that there is the visible part of our personality, which is the body. There is the invisible part of our personality, which would encompass mind, intellect, ego, our hopes, fears, everything that is a part of ourselves, but which no surgeon will find when the body is cut open. So that, I would say, is the invisible part of who we are. The question often is there anything beyond these physical, visible and invisible parts? And I would imagine that most a materialist view of life, where we don't see anything, whether there's anything beyond matter, would probably end there. In which case, the invisible part would most likely be reduced to just the neurological function of the brain. In the Hindu tradition, and I suppose in one way, one form or other, in other religions as well, they believe there is something more to us than simply the body and mind. And that something more is the non, according to Hindu way of understanding, is the non-material part of our personality. So the body and mind, according to them, have to follow the laws of matter. But this third something, call it spirit, call it the real self, whichever way you call it, the Hindus say it as a non-material. In other words, it doesn't follow the laws of matter. And laws of matter would simply mean, in very broad terms, that there is a beginning, there is an end. What we normally say, birth and death. There is change, there is transformation. So the spirit is unaffected by all of these. And the Hindus believe that our true nature, that in reality, every one of us is the spirit. So in reality, every one of us is birthless and deathless. We are immortal. Of course, that's not how we feel today. We are. We feel we are born at some time. We feel we will die at some day. And the reason we feel that way, according to Hindu way of thinking, is that we have this body and mind. And according to Hindu understanding, the body and mind are coverings. Just like the clothes cover us, the body and mind cover the spirit. But somehow, due to wrong, what they call wrong perception or misperception, we have begun to see the coverings as our own selves. And that, the Hindu tradition sees as the primal cause of the existential situation in which we find ourselves. In other words, if we look at our present life, there is clearly a wonderful thing. There is a lot of things to rejoice, but there are a lot of things which are painful as well. There are things which give pleasure, but there are also things which give a lot of pain. Now, we don't have any problem with pleasure, obviously. The problem is, what do we do with the pain? Is it possible to have only pleasure in life without the accompanying pain? Is it possible to simply be happy and not be unhappy? Now that's been the kind of quest. And I said in the beginning that love is something that would lead to unity. So what the Hindu understanding is this, then the body and mind have their own characteristics and they have their own demands, what we say the biological demands of the body. And so clearly the body needs food, there's hunger, there's thirst, there is desire to procreate. So all of these things are connected with the body. And as so long as we feel that identity with the body, we are bound by both the joy that the body gives and the pain that the body gives. So long as we are identified with the mind, we are connected with the joy that the mind gives and the pain that the mind gives. How do we know? Is this simply a theoretical formulation, or there is some rational way of at least making sense out of this? And one way would be to think, in the Hindu text they say, is our experience when we are fast asleep. In deep sleep, we apparently still have our body and mind just lying in bed, but we are not identified at that time with the body and mind. And in that state of deep sleep, we are completely disconnected from whatever pain or sorrow or suffering the body and mind have. You might still have a headache, you might still have a shoulder ache, but if you're fast asleep, as long as you're asleep, you won't feel that. And so they associate, therefore, that all our experience of joy and sorrow, pleasure and pain, is connected with the identity with the body and mind. Love. One other point that gets stressed in the Hindu tradition is the distinction between love and attachment. Many of the Hindu religious texts speak strongly about the problem of attachment. They don't speak about the problem of love. Love is wonderful. But the problem is that externally, the two look pretty similar. How do I know whether I love somebody or I'm attached to somebody? Love is seen as a power that's transcendent, that comes from God, or that comes from something higher than just this visible material thing. And so love is always seen in a very positive way. But attachment is seen, the difference is this, the way the Hindu text sees it, that love is empowering. Love is something that frees the person who is in love and frees the person who is being loved. Attachment, on the other hand, spreads the tentacles of ownership. You're attached to someone, this person is mine, this person belongs to me. And with the sense of ownership will come the feeling of the person being snatched away from me, being taken away from me, and the pain and suffering associated with that. We also see the difference between love and attachment more clearly in the kind of effect it produces. Just love is a very produces an experience of complete contentment, fulfillment, joy. On the other hand, attachment, where we see the fear of our object of love being kind of taken away from us, there is fear, there is sometimes jealousy, there is suspicion, anger. Now, in most relationships, we find that there is a great joy, there is great fulfillment, there is contentment, but alongside that, there are occasions when we feel anger, we feel a little envious, we feel jealousy, and which would lead us to a kind of conclusion that probably most relationships are a mixture of both love and attachment. The pain that is caused in a relationship, the suffering that is caused, not because of love, is, according to Hindu way of thinking, it's because of attachment. And the more we are able to eliminate attachment, the greater or more satisfying would that relationship be. And one more point, and it is this. The Hindu texts also emphasize that when we derive joy from something, pleasure for something, the source of our pleasure or the source of our joy would determine the strength of the pleasure or joy as well. Now, among the pleasures known to us in human being, clearly, the pleasure from sexual activity is among the top and the highest. But what is the source of that pleasure? If whatever, if it could be just a chocolate ice cream, it could be some food, it could be some person, it could be whichever way. But if the source of my pleasure, the source of my joy is perishable, is temporary, then I cannot expect infinite pleasure, infinite joy, unending pleasure from a perishable entity. And so, if so long as we are clear about these things, that, well, if I love ice cream, and then as long as I have that ice cream, I'm going to be happy. Once that's gone, I'm either going to want more and be unhappy until I get the second one. So the Hindu religious texts say that eventually when we speak about evolution, that just as there is physical evolution, there is psychological evolution, there is such a thing as the spiritual evolution. In other words, can we, as we learn through our experience, what would religious maturity be? And the Hindu texts see that, that if we can try to find love and pleasure and joy in something which is more lasting, something which is non-perishable. And non-perishable in religious texts always take the form of God. And I'm using the word God, but again, because we all have our preconceived ideas or prejudices against the term itself. But I would simply say that if we believe, and that again goes back to the worldview, if we believe that there is something deeper behind this existence of ours, something more than what is immediately visible, something more than simply what our scientific instruments can help us see, there is something more than that, then that something more will necessarily will have to be immaterial, not subject to the laws of matter. And if we can, now, would extending our love to this abstract, invisible thing, would it make us love other world or people in it less? And the Hindu texts say no. In fact, whoever we love, if we are able to see the face of the divine within them, if we are able to see the transcendent in the immanent, if we are able to see the deeper meaning behind the person in front, we would, that love would be on a much stronger foundation. And so how we see the world, how we see the people in the world, how we see the person we love will so much depend on how we see our own selves. So our concept of the world, our concept of the people around us is directly related to our concept of our own selves. In religious context, oftentimes we hear the term, God is our father, God is our mother, we are all children of God. Now, it seems like a good idea for those who believe in religion, but it's not so easy to see everyone as a child of God. The reason it's not easy is that it'll become easy. If I'm able to see myself as a child of God, it'll become easier for me to see others as children of God. Now, because I see myself as a human being, it has become easier for me to see everyone as a human being. So how we see ourselves makes all the difference. You can ask people about what do you think about the world. Some people say, oh, this is so wonderful, this is a great place. And so, why about the world? You can just ask about MIT. Ask some people, like, what do you think about this? Some say, oh, this is such a great place. And some be like, oh, this is lousy, this is terrible. And you wonder whether they're speaking about the same place. So what we see and how we understand what's outside of us is so much colored by how our mind perceives ourselves and this thing. And so these ideas about love, sex, and even religion are so much based on our self-understanding of ourselves and our understanding of the world around us. And I think, these are some of the thoughts that come to mind, and then we can discuss furthermore. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Well, my name is Adam Reynolds. It's great to be here with you today. When I got the invitation to be a part of this panel, I think my answer was a pretty immediate yes. Hope it's not TMI, but this is one of my favorite topics. So here we are. So just a little bit of background about me. I first came to MIT for undergrad. I was a physics major, class of 2001, and I've sort of been around MIT ever since. So it's been a while now. This is my fourth year as one of MIT's chaplains, and I love being at a chaplain at MIT because I can have a conversation with somebody and we can talk about both God and gravitational waves in the same conversation, and that is super fun. So I am representing something called Blue Ocean Faith. I'll maybe say a couple words about that because my guess is no one has ever heard of it. And there's sort of there's maybe a paradox in our identity in Blue Ocean Faith. So we are a new take on a very old thing, that old thing being faith in Jesus. As I understand it, we're squarely in the mainstream of what it's always meant to follow Jesus for the past 2,000 years. And there's some things that feel distinctive to us, namely that we understand faith thoroughly in terms of relationship. Everything is in relational terms for us. So we have a focus on relationship with God and Jesus and helping people to experience that connection and relationship. But we're not actually concerned at all with whether people are Christians or not, or becoming Christians. So on to today's topic, which I don't know what it says about me, but of sex, love, and religion, I'm mostly focusing on sex. In this context, when I say that, I'll be referring to sex between consenting adults. So three things I want to say about sex. First is God likes sex. Actually, I think he really likes sex, because if there is a God, after all, then it seems like he created sex. He designed it to be what it is. And actually, I could maybe even try and make the case that sex is one of God's favorite things. So you may be aware, the first story in the Bible in Genesis, Adam and Eve, the first command ever given to humanity, be fruitful and multiply, which is maybe also the first sexual euphemism. Be fruitful, wink, wink, and multiply. You may be aware that the Bible contains pretty steamy, graphic love poetry. It's in there. And most of all, and maybe most interestingly and most awkwardly, the passionate sexual relationship between two lovers is sort of the culminating metaphor for the sort of relationship that God wants to have with people, that level of intimacy. So all to say, I think our sexuality is good. God sees it as a good thing, and it's meant to be, as I understand it, a gift to us. And that gift is about connection. It's about intimacy, maybe about unity, as Swami was saying. And I think intimacy is maybe what God cares the most about, just in general. But there's an enemy of intimacy, which we all experience, which is isolation. And I think if there is a God, he has hardwired us to try and find ways to overcome that isolation and experience intimacy. And I think at the heart of it, that's what we're trying to do when we're having sex. We're trying to overcome that feeling of isolation and experience a deep intimacy. And sometimes it goes well or poorly, but that's sort of the heart of what we're after, I think. And in that sense, I think we are doing what we were created to do. So my second point on this topic is that historically, as I can see, the church, the Christian church, has done a really poor job of handling this issue. We've put lots of shame on people for their sexual choices, and shame, in my experience, is isolating. It's not bringing intimacy, it's destroying it, and I think that's been super unhelpful. Somehow we've managed to project an image of God that is like super ticked off at people for having sex. Many people have been made to feel by the church, maybe especially women, that they're somehow like less or damaged goods if they've lost their virginity. And in some circles, there's talk as if having sex before marriage will instantly and irreparably sabotage your hopes for a happy marriage. And so I think these things are A, false, and B, destructive. So I don't know if anybody here has sort of fallen victim to like some of these messages or like shameful things. But if that's the case, to whatever extent I can represent the Christian church, I would say I'm sorry, like offer like genuine apology for that, because I think it's caused a lot of damage, and to my mind, it has profoundly misrepresented God, profoundly. So I don't think that God angrily begrudges us as we make attempts for intimacy, even if they end up misfiring, if poor choices are made. I don't see God as angry or wrathful in that instance. God is not looking to smite us for our sexual choices. Though God may obviously feel concerned if our sexuality has ceased to be a gift and has become a source of pain or isolation. So Christianity maybe doesn't have such a good record on this, but the good news is I think Jesus does an amazing job at handling this issue. So from the stories of Jesus, you may be aware that Jesus, he hung out with prostitutes, which in his setting, as somebody who's seen as a religious leader, is like a super big deal, a super big no-no. It's just completely off the table. And in hanging out with them, he's not there preaching at them, telling them to clean up their act and, you know, start being a good moral religious person. He doesn't seem to be mad at them or disappointed at them. He actually seems to appreciate them as people and like spending time with them. He shows them love, and they actually feel loved and accepted in his presence, and feel like, you know, he's offering some kind of help. And I think Jesus offers like the best window to my mind of what God is like and how he feels about this issue and how he responds to us. So extrapolating from those stories, I feel confident saying, like, you know, God is not mad at us. He's not mad at you or disappointed in you for any sexual choices. He's offering help if help is wanted or needed. I think, this is my third point, I think God wants to actively help your sex life to go great. He wants you to thrive in that area just like he wants you to thrive in every other area. He wants that to be and feel like a gift to you. In my experience, a sex life that's healthy and fun and fulfilling over the long haul, over a lifetime, is not easy to pull off. There's a lot of challenges that we can face in that endeavor. Sexuality seems to be something that is both very powerful and very delicate, and not to mention deeply complex. So there's all sorts of ways that it can go wrong. And because it's so powerful and because it taps into like the very core of who I am, when it does go wrong, it can go pretty profoundly wrong and be like a deep sense of pain and isolation. The good news to my mind is that God, you know, God loves us. God loves you always and is always on your side, is always wanting to help. And it's not sort of like, oh, if you can somehow like clean up your act and do better and like follow the rules, then God will help you. Not the case at all. Like, I think God is offering help to all of us wherever we are in the moment. If you wanted God's help with your sex life, again, I think that if is important, because if you don't want it, God has given you the freedom to not seek it out. If that's something you want, what might that look like? In practical terms, maybe it just boils down to asking God for help, maybe just generically. More specifically, if you feel like, oh, I could use some guidance in making some sexual decisions or figuring out how to navigate this, I think God would be glad to give that guidance. In my mind, healthy sexuality boils down to understanding what sex is. I don't think that's a straightforward question. I think that's actually like a really deep question. In the journey that we all have of figuring out what sex is, we have to figure out what sources are trustworthy to teach us about sex. Maybe that's not a straightforward question either. Because there'll be lots of information coming at us from different directions. What are we going to trust? Maybe we learn about sex from our parents. Maybe we learn about sex from health class. Maybe we learn about sex from HBO, from the internet. And so we have to figure out, like, what am I going to trust? And I think plenty of us learn about sex through trial and error. But I'm just putting out the pitch that exploring the possibility that God is a trustworthy source to teach us about sex. And that's all for me.
My name is Carrie Jo Verhulst. I serve here as Lutheran chaplain to MIT. How many of you have heard of Martin Luther? Not Martin Luther King Jr., who's really the more... he's not known as somebody generally who's body positive or sex positive, but in fact he was. But I don't know if you've seen, there's a thing that goes around Facebook in my church nerd circles of the Lutheran Insulter, where he said really fabulously scatological things full of bile about the Pope and other people who he was resisting against during the Reformation. And that's kind of what he's known for. But he also had a big emphasis on what we call in Christian, it's not just Christian language, but I'm speaking from that perspective, incarnation. That we know God as Christians most especially in Jesus, where God, who is beyond all knowing, becomes tangible and contained. He has these beautiful Christmas meditations on the manger and the sort of apprehension of, like, if you want to know the Almighty, look at this squirmy baby. And he has long passages about changing babies' diapers as holy action, which he's resisting it in monastic culture. So I'm actually not going to talk that much about Luther, though, even though I just did. I want to talk a little bit, kind of somewhat similar to Adam, but in a more theologically nerdy way, which is true to my Lutheran tradition, about some of the history for how the Christian tradition has viewed sexuality and some of the more hopeful movements that have happened in the past, really since the 60s, thanks to feminism, thanks to the LGBTQ movements, thanks to liberation theology, which is a movement that came out of especially oppressed peoples saying, if God is a God of love, why am I poor? And my church has told me to just sort of be content and this is God's will for me, but I resist that. Which effected a shift from understanding that you only understand who God is through church dogma or scripture to saying, we are revelation. The stuff of our bodies and the stuff of our lives, because we encounter God in the flesh, in Jesus, is data about the divine. And this is a pretty big difference, I think, from a Hindu worldview, that we only know through the body. And there is more beyond, yes, but the body is how we connect. It's how we have relationship. It's how we go through this world. But for most of Christian tradition, as Adam referenced, sexuality was viewed as something to be feared and controlled and restrained. And this especially was put on women, it's kind of fun being the only woman on this panel. I am cisgender. I am married to a man. So my perspective of liberation is, like all of our perspectives, sort of confined in that I haven't experienced myself to have a gender identity or sexual identity that is considered minority. But I've had students ask me in my office, well, what does the Bible say about this? What does the Bible say about this? And my very quick throwaway answer is the Bible is not a helpful place to go to for an initial frame of reference for understanding ourselves as sexual beings. There is erotic love poetry. I have a little excerpt from the Song of Solomon. As an apple tree among the trees of the wood, and this is all metaphor, of course. We're talking about the body here. So is my beloved among young men. With great delight I sat in his shadow, wink, wink, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his intention towards me was love. I grew up singing this as a song about Jesus, which is what happened to the Song of Solomon. It's this erotic love poetry that gets into the canon. Is it in the Jewish canon?
Yeah.
Okay. I plead ignorance in knowing there are some things that are and some things aren't. And it gets picked up by the monastic imagination in like the 1300s. St. Bernard of Clairvaux writes like 85 sermons on the first two chapters of the Song of Solomon. And it's all about this divine human erotic connection. And it's beautiful, but it's totally taken away from the actual bodily experience of being fleshy, desirous, arousable beings. Luther didn't want it in the canon. He thought it was highly problematic. Because of that, it was so sort of weird and out of control. But the people who wanted it in there prevailed. Part of this severing of sort of thinking of sexuality as something to be controlled, confined within the bonds of heterosexual marriage, of course, for the purpose of procreation, which became then more of a Catholic emphasis. I don't know, is anybody in the room Catholic or has Catholic background? And I want to be careful about how I present it, but way too church nerdy I'm being now, but it has to do with sort of understandings of natural law and that every act has an ultimate purpose. And therefore, the purpose of procreation becomes, in a certain understanding of Catholic moral theology, essential to every act of sex. I'm going to talk more about acts of sex and why I find that a hugely problematic term anyway. And so you get this rarefied view of the sex act as being sort of confined in this thing. And then you have the sort of monastic culture and the culture of celibacy, where there's this amazing spirituality and theology of mystical union with God. And you have these largely women, medieval mystics, writing these, having these experiences of like orgasms while receiving the Eucharist. But of course, they don't have, and it's like their hands are up here. Like they're not touching their bodies, you know? It's this really fascinating, like it make you blush sensual theology, but like, their hands are in the air. They are not touching themselves kind of thing. It's all God. And it was controlled, too, within the church, within the hierarchy. They all had male confessors, many of whom wrote their... Anyway, blah, 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 blah. So this dualism, do you know the term dualism? This splitting of sort of sex and the sacred also manifested itself in a splitting of spirit and body. And again, for women especially, and for poor people, this all became a function of control. One of the readers I was reading in preparation for this talked about how in this dualism, spirit is opposed to body, with spirit assumed to be higher and superior and the body lower and inferior. And the companion of this dualism has been sexism or patriarchy. Men were identified with the spirit and the mind, and men identified women with the body. So you have Thomas Aquinas and women are like deficient males. Like we almost got there, but we didn't quite, you know, get the whole way. The good news, as I referenced in the beginning, is that there's been a real shift in certain spheres of theology. I am not by any means representing a lot of the Christian communities on this campus. I'm going to be perfectly honest about that. There are a lot of Christian communities on this campus who would find what I'm saying hugely problematic, which was why we need to do our inter-Christian fighting panel, because that would be really fun.
Someday.
But in terms of understanding sexuality as intrinsic to the divine human relationship and intrinsic to who we are. And so rather than saying, what does the Bible say or what does the church say I can and can't do as a sexual being, it's an understanding of, like, I experience life as a created child of God, the God who chose to become known to us most particularly in the flesh. And what does my experience in the flesh, what does my experience of desire and longing and attempt for connection but missing it, you know? I mean, sex is like communication, you know, and sometimes you connect and sometimes it's like, okay, we're not connecting. And I don't just mean physically, I mean whole person-wise. And so our bodies become not sort of incidental stumbling blocks that need to be controlled, but they're means through which we connect with each other and with God. And so sexuality is not just instrumental to or detrimental to the experience of God, but it's essential, it's important. And this facet of ourselves as sexual beings is manifest in all aspects of our lives. It's not just acts, discrete acts, either with ourselves in relationship to our sexual organs, I hate that word, or with another person. It's sort of like the erotic, the capacity to be desirous and creative, is it infuses all of our relationships. And boundaries can be violated, and that's where there is a reality of danger, if you want to use that word. And safety is essential, especially when there are power imbalances. Especially, oh, am I over time?
No,
okay. Especially when there are power differences. And I think that is one of the chief lenses through which, as moral beings, we sort of adjudicate how we choose to connect. But it is part of who we are. And the last thing I want to say, because I know I'm probably going on too long, is what I've mentioned a couple of times, why I really hate the idea of being sexually active or sexually inactive. These are medical categories. I think they're important categories. Our doctors need to know what we're doing so they know what to tell us to be concerned about or on the lookout for. I was raised in a tradition where there was a line in the sand, and it was, maybe really graphic, it was male penile penetration, which itself is such a hugely, I mean, not only is it heteronormative, but there's so much patriarchy embedded in that. But if you weren't doing that, you were okay. And you see this in a lot of communities where there has been abstinence-only sex education, and the definition of sex is the penis enters the vagina, and you have young people engaging in super risky behaviors in terms of STDs because they're not having sex. Or they're gay, and so what they're doing with their same gender partner isn't having sex. And the relationship gets so oddly rarefied that there's this one thing you can't do. There are Christian cultures where you're completely inactive in any way, shape, or form until you get married. And then it's like, and now you're supposed to have this rich, fulfilling, divine, reflecting sexual relationship with your spouse, and you were never allowed to discover your own body, unless you maybe had one of those magical orgasms where you didn't have anything to do with it because it was Jesus. I'm being flipped, sorry. But all of a sudden you're now in this partnership and you're just like, holy man, I don't know my own body. I don't know what I need. I just know I have these desires and I'm supposed to figure you out. And at the same time, we're supposed to be modeling this union of Christ with his church and we're supposed to be open to the possibility of children. And it's you've been infantilized as a human being and a sexual being. And now all of a sudden, like, and now you're a grown-up, go. There are statistics that show that a lot of these marriages don't last because people are like, I had no idea who I was. This whole facet of who I am wasn't available to me. And all of a sudden this was expected of me. At the same time, I want to say, when I was asked to be on this panel, I did not leap to it. I was like, I'm too much of a prude. I read the brochure and I was like, rolling bananas and chocolate? I'm like, I couldn't. I'm nervous. I'm like, I'm sexually active because I'm married and I'm married to a man who has a penis. Anyway, but I'm like, no. But then it caused me to do some really helpful self-reflection about, like, well, why do I jump to that word about myself? And what is it about my relationship to my sexuality and my body and the privacy that for me is helpful and important in terms of safety and the right to tell my story and the right to be seen, the right to be choose with whom I am naked in every sense of the word rather than just, you know, changing in the locker room. And sort of dialing it back to say, you can be sexually active even if you're not doing anything with certain body parts. You know, it is who you are. I know there's a separate panel addressing asexuality, and so I don't want to totally universalize the experience that everybody experiences desire necessarily, because some people don't, and to allow for that reality as well. Final thought is, if you are wondering for yourself, or if those of you who are GRTs have students who trust you enough to have these conversations with you about negotiating, what can I do, what do I do, I want to suggest questions instead of around, like, again, like, what's the line in the sand for you? How far did you go? Did you cross it? But questions that the prior two panelists have alluded to in terms of, like, what is it for you to be naked with somebody? What is it for you to regard yourself as somebody desired by the divine, by the ultimate, a recipient of that level of desire and worthy of that? What is it for you to trust someone. As my colleague's stepmother said to her when she was 13, well, it can get messy. So you want to make sure you trust the person you're sort of exploring and experimenting this with. And I think that's just a really, it's so basic and so non-shame-based and so loving and practical. And then to think of it as sort of like, if there is shame that comes up, what if that is put on you? What if that is helpful information to reflect on? What labels do you jump to for yourself and others? Yeah, I'm going to leave it at that.
Thanks for being flipped.
It's my specialty.
Thanks for opening a lot of that up, because I think that, hi everyone, I'm Gabriel. I work at Hillel, that's the Jewish organization on campus. And it would be extraordinarily presumptuous for me to pretend that I could represent all of Judaism, because there's a lot of diversity within Jewish approaches to sexuality, like there are a variety of approaches within Judaism to everything from, you know, occupation to
food
and everything in between and beyond. But I think Carrie Jo, I think what you bring out that's so important is a need to look honestly at the discrepancy between what a religion thinks it says about sexuality, among other things, mm-hmm. and how people are living it on the ground, mm-hmm. and how that's working. Judaism, I think most religions. I believe the Dalai Lama disagreed about this. I heard a panel with him about this topic. But Judaism seems to say or to imply that sex is a holy act. It is powerful. This is not new. Freud made that abundantly clear. It is powerful. It is subject to all these emotions and types of experiences that a person could have. So I'm going to set my timer because I know how I get. Set timer for 9 minutes. Thanks.
Series in the
thanks,
room.
And ostensibly, like, the basic shape is that Judaism understands that sex is powerful and volatile. Sex makes people crazy. Not the act of sex makes people nuts, but literally, the pursuit of sex makes people act in ways that are not rational. It can bring out people's neuroses. It can make people bitter and jealous and competitive. Like, there's so many ways that sex can it can become distracting, which is one of the main anxieties that Judaism might be said to have around sex, is that sex can become a distraction that prevents a person from focusing on the ultimate task at hand. What are we doing here in the world? And Judaism is decidedly, I wouldn't say decidedly, but certainly not entirely an Epicurean religion that's just devoted to pleasure. There's pleasure is certainly a part of it, but there's a lot more to talk about. There's a whole mission. We're doing something here. We've got something to do in the world, and sex is a part of that, and it's an important part of that, and it's a nourishing part of that, and it's and yet if it becomes sort of out of control, it becomes demonic, as it were, then something's gone wrong. So one rabbi encouraged people not to hang out like roosters. That apparently roosters, I guess in the mood all the time, and they're kind of like when I haven't spent a lot of time with roosters, but I guess when roosters are around hens, they are one track mind. I imagine most roosters are not many track minds anyway, but at those particular moments they get pretty pretty clear on their intents. And so not to spend all your time like looking to have sex at any given time, meaning that this could become again a distraction from a sense of ultimate purpose. So I think that's a basic sort of opening salvo. What does Judaism tend to think about sex in general? But then stage two is then going to be, okay, so how do we kind of give form and structure and limitation around this holy thing in order to make sure that it is positive and remains positive and remains a conduit of love and connection and intimacy? And therein, Judaism introduces all sorts of structures and laws and understandings about how to do that, how to make sure that sex remains awesome. Right, and how does it remain as deeply pleasurable as possible, not just physically pleasurable, but how does it remain a conduit for intimacy,
How does it, and so those are the kinds of questions that, that Jewish law tends to concern itself. And then you end up with a set of practices that that traditional Judaism espouses that seem understandable within this context and interesting, and yet when they are lived on the ground, it becomes very difficult for people. So they might be like if they were lived by the perfect saint, you know, the person who gets it and doesn't have any anxieties about it and just lives it in a certain way, that could be a wonderful thing. But we definitely get a sense, just as a rabbi here, I tend not to deal with these questions so much, but as a rabbi of a congregation in Colorado for 10 years, these kinds of things came up all the time, where people are just like, these laws, these rules and structures and frameworks are not working. There's something about it which is alienating people, which is creating pain and anxiety in the place where it's supposed to be conduit for pleasure. So just I'll give a couple examples of practices around Jewish sexuality. I'll give three examples that can cause a lot of pain and or confusion. So one of them is I was asked by a student here. Now there's a thing called in Judaism called Shomer Negiyah, which means man and woman are not going to touch until they're married, right? Outside of immediate family members, a young Orthodox person is not going to touch a person of the opposite gender until they get married. They might date. There's not going to be any touching, not going to be any hand-holding or hugging, no making out, and certainly nothing beyond that. And the idea was to keep this in sort of a pure state. This is something that I'm not going to be tainted by. I'm going to grow up and develop with this person, right? We're going to explore it. We're going to discover and explore our sexuality together. That's great if you're getting married at 14. Right, yeah. And that's how old they were when they were getting married. And you know, in the 17th century, they were 14 years old, and 13 or 14 years old. And you had your bar bat mitzvah, and then you pretty much like maybe studied for a year, and then you got married. They actually got engaged at the beginning of that year, went and studied for a year, came back, got married. You know, your grandparent by 30, right? I don't know. 30. So it's that's lovely, but now you're a 22-year-old college student who's Orthodox, who hasn't touched a woman yet. You are out of control. I mean, your desires are just rampant. It doesn't make any sense at that point, or does it make sense? How do you fit yourself into the context of a practice that requires you not to touch? You're dating because you want to, and you're emotionally lonely. You want someone that you can have a connection with, and at the same time, you're trying to not touch that person. There's even a thing called yichud, which is not even being alone with that person. So that becomes a practice which can be very difficult to manage. And so I actually have a meeting today with a couple of people who are struggling with that very question. And I don't know what I'm going to say. You know, I don't know what I'm going to say to that. What I really want to say is get married, but I'm probably not going to say that. But it is interesting. It's, you know, so sort of a quandary, and then how do people develop a practice within that that they can feel good about and not cause themselves too much pain. A second practice is, and this is not about sexuality, this is really an adjunct practice that meets with sexuality, which is Jewish menstrual law. Jewish menstrual law is very intense. When a man and woman are married, and the woman is menstruating, the man and the woman are not touching during that time. They're not having sex, they're not even sleeping in the same bed. According to Orthodox practice, they're not even passing each other's stuff. They literally are not even experiencing the mildly erotic experience of here is a cup, right? And you can't, right? So, would you be surprised how erotic that can become when you haven't done it for 2 weeks? So a woman has, right? So a woman, at the onset of her menses, they separate for usually about 5 days, and then at the end of that period, there's a 7-day waiting period where she becomes clean, then she goes to the ritual bath, and then they come back together. And the idea was like, okay, now, and that's called mikvah night, when, you know, she comes back from the mikvah, the ritual bath, and then they're going to have sex.
And then she's ovulating, so she'll get pregnant.
What is it?
And then she's ovulating, so she'll get pregnant.
She's ovulating, everything's so lovely, so everything's great there. And so we're then supposed to have this like second honeymoon, which is like amazing, because we haven't touched for 2 weeks, we're literally like out of our minds, and then we're pretty excited to get back together again. And that's a practice that can be, and for some people that really, really works and helps, and it keeps it alive. Like if you're having sex all the time, you know, every day or whenever you want, it could get old, right? So there's a sense of like, ostensibly, a sense of renewal that occurs every month for, you know, until menopause, and that can be very revitalizing. There's some problems with that. Some people, like during those 2 weeks when they're apart, it's sometimes hard to communicate, and like usual ways of expressing caring are taken away from you. Even if it's just a hug, right? So on the front side, again, in the best way, it really encourages. Oh my God. That was so quick. It really encourages people to develop other ways of communicating and sharing love and expressing that caring. at the same time, it can be very difficult for people to do that. Coming together is not necessarily this magical, you know, sex wonderland that it's supposed to be. This issue is, what if a woman ovulates a day early? I mean, there's hormonal treatments and pregnancy stuff. So again, that's a place where like there's this set of practices and laws, and then a human being might come along and say, I'm really having a hard time with this. How do I now adapt around this? A third thing to mention, and I think it has to be said, is Judaism's relationship to homosexuality, which is, you know, in the Old Testament, the clear and simple reading of the Old Testament is that homosexuality is not allowed. And so that's whatever it is. But then, you know, in the world, and you have people who are good people, obviously, who are saying, I'm homosexual, and then what am I going to do? Am I going to live my whole life without having any intimacy? Physical intimacy, even, or even just emotional intimacy? Like, what's sort of allowed here? So then the system has to adapt or respond, you know, to a person who's saying, like, I'm a human being. Every human being has a right to intimacy and to that kind of connection. What do you have for me? And so those are three ways that, again, there's a kind of system which ostensibly has certain principles that are embedded within it, but when it's lived on the ground, it can become very difficult. I will say that, like, within the kind of, like, once you've got all the kind of things taken care of, okay, so we're not menstruating and we're allowed to be together and we're already married and these kinds of things, at that point, Judaism is way sex positive, right? At that point, Judaism has very little restraint on what any couple would, you know, be interested in doing at that time. There's some religions that do, and there are some branches of Judaism that do, but essentially at that point, like, go for it. You guys are, like, you guys are each other's, and you should enjoy that as much as you can. So, because it's important, and it's essential that people really validate that piece of themselves. And so you might have just heard that myth of, like, Orthodox Jews doing it through a sheet with a hole in it. Yeah, is that one? You ever heard that one? Because it's not true. So, it's all, you know, the idea is, like, we're very Puritan, but, like, we have this, like, we have to have sex, but we got a sheet with a hole in the middle, and we'll have sex, like, through the hole in the sheet, but ultimately we're not here to enjoy it for procreation. It's really not. That's a myth. It's because they saw in the laundry lines a thing called a tzitzit, which is like a garment, which is a rectangular garment with a circle in the middle that you put over your head, kind of like a, I don't know, like a cable or something. They saw it on the laundry line, and they figured that was the sex sheet. As awful as that is.
More anti-Semitism.
Right. It's probably Jews who are doing it. But so ultimately at that point, though, that there's really, you know, the hope is that this couple will use sex as a way to really cultivate their love and to remain connected to each other in a very deep way, and therefore it should be satisfying and requires deep communication and requires honesty, and when it's, you know, done right, or, you know, that can be obviously be extremely nourishing, but there's a lot of room for people to kind of get frustrated or ticked off or closed down from all the different pieces around that. So it's a journey, right? It really requires a lot of sincerity and positive intention and communication in order to make sex be the most positive thing that it can be.